Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today is the last day of Your Call's special election series. For the past 2 weeks, we've been focusing on local measures and state propositions. We also discussed the state Senate race between Senator Scott Wiener and Jackie Fielder. You can find those shows at yourcallradio.com. Today, we are discussing three California propositions. Proposition 25 would make California the first state to replace cash bail. This would transform how people get out of jail while awaiting trial. Most people booked into jail on misdemeanor charges would be released within 12 hours. A report from the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California estimates that 142,500 misdemeanor defendants would be released from jail more quickly as a result. And to learn more about Prop 25, we are joined by Bob Agelko, staff writer with the San Francisco Chronicle. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's great to have you, Bob. So in 2018, Governor Jerry Brown approved the no-bail law. SB 10 was supposed to go into effect in October 2019. The bail bond companies and their insurers spent more than $3 million to collect signatures and put this on the 2020 ballot. The challenge to SB 10 put the law on hold until voters decide whether to approve it on November 3rd. So, Bob, can you just give us a little more information on the backstory here?
Obviously, bail bond companies have a big stake in this. Their entire income is the 10% fees that they charge for bonds that most people need to get out of jail. $560 million worth of fees in one recent year. So without this, there would be no bail bond companies. However, during the campaign, the bail bond companies who raised the money to put this on the ballot have basically been invisible. The No on 25 campaign is being promoted, not without some reason, saying that this measure could actually make racial inequality worse. I say not without some reason. There's considerable dispute on it because the new system that would be in place to decide whether people should stay in jail until trial is based on computer programming and all that has been alleged to be somewhat racially biased. I don't want to get ahead of myself, but basically the companies that have the most at stake and that have funded the campaign are nowhere to be found in the public debate or in the ballot pamphlet, which is between two opposing sides saying this is the best system for public safety and for freedom for people who don't deserve to be in jail simply because they can't afford it. I mean, that's the critique of the bail system, of course, that allows you to buy your way out, and people who stay in jail, which is a majority of the jail population at any given time, haven't been convicted of any crimes, but are simply there because they can't afford bail. So this new system, shall I go on and describe it a little more?
Before you do that, just what you said right there is really important, because people with money can afford cash bail. Poor people, low-income people, either pay bail bond companies or they have to wait for trial in jail.
Right. Well, correct, and it's, anyway.
Yeah, so if you can just elaborate on that a bit, because that's a really important point to make.
That's the system in effect in just about every state in the country, that once you are booked, even before arraignment and formal charges, you stay in jail unless either you can pay your way out, that is, post bail or pay the bail bond company, or you are released without bail because your crime is so minor that it doesn't require it. Otherwise, you can stay in until trial, and that in turn puts pressure on a lot of defendants to make deals, to plead guilty to a crime rather than to go to trial, simply because, otherwise they're just locked up. Maybe they can get a better sentence. So the question is whether the bail system really promotes justice in the sense that maybe people are pleading to charges that a prosecutor could not approved. In any event, there's been a considerable pressure and clamor for quite some time to change the system. Among the advocates, of all people, is California's Chief Justice, Tani Katil Sakaue, who has said publicly and through her judicial counsel that the cash bail system is obsolete and unjust, and has supported SB 10 while it was in the legislature, and as had quite a number of civil rights groups. But when the bill was amended in the late going to shore up support and put in some of these tests for future release, it lost some of its support. Some groups went neutral. The American Civil Liberties Union, that has long supported these bail changes, dropped its support and is neutral on the ballot measure. Some others have actually opposed it. The reason being that once it's determined that a person should be released only if they, without bail, only if they don't pose a threat, the system that most counties will use is based on computer algorithms that take into account such things as a person's criminal record, past drug use, work history, community ties, factors that can well be racially biased. That it has been said would result in, maybe in more racial minorities being held in jail without bail. The fact is that that SB 10, if it passes as Prop 25, will result in more people being released from jail pending trial than the current system. But the question is, who's going to be kept in? And it's been said by some opponents, including the head of the NAACP in California, that this is going to be racially skewed, and the new system will be more racist than the old one. Hard for me to assess something like that. And as I said, there doesn't seem to be much doubt that more people will get out. Question is, will the people who stay in be kept there because they're not safe to release, or maybe under a system that takes more, that is tilted racially? And that's certainly a question that the people are going to have to contemplate, assuming that they have time to really contemplate what's in Prop 25. And the other thing I should say, just to clear up any confusion, this is a referendum, but a yes vote on 25 means that SB 10 becomes law. So if you support getting rid of bail, vote yes on 25. If you don't, or if you don't support the new law, vote no. Because sometimes there's confusion when a referendum qualifies. Do you support the referendum? Basically, you're being asked whether you support the law.
You mentioned the California NAACP. You're talking about Alice Huffman?
Right.
Okay, so we should mention that her public affairs campaign has received $200,000 from the No on 25 campaign. We talked about the money that her firm is receiving from these propositions. So she's on these mailers, but mm-hmm. there's no transparency letting people know that she's actually being paid by these campaigns.
Yeah, I have tried to reach her without any success about this. But the fact is that No on 25 lists both her and the organization as supporters. I don't think that's true nationally, and it's certainly not true of all civil rights organizations in California, but they are definitely a leading and noted organization, and her name is on the ballot arguments against 25.
Right. And others who oppose it, the California Peace Officers Association, California Bail Agents Association, major donors are AIA Holdings, a bail bond company, Trinton Management Services, parent company of Aladdin Bail Bonds. And so far, they've spent almost $10 million to oppose Prop 25. This is according to CalMatters. Those in favor include the SEIU, the California Democratic Party. Major donors include Connie Ballmer, a philanthropist, Steve Ballmer, Clippers owner, John Arnold, a hedge fund manager, and they've spent just over $12 million to support Prop 25.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely a very well-funded campaign on both sides. And as I said, I think maybe the public would have been better served if the donors, I don't know, had been out front in the campaign. So we know that to a certain extent, at least, this is a referendum on the role of bail bond companies and not on civil rights, involved in bail. But it's a real issue about whether the new system will be fair. In fact, Equal Justice Under Law, which is an East Coast-based organization that has sponsored legal challenges to the bail system, has come out against Prop 25. They said, we want to get rid of the bail system, but there's simply better ways to do it. And that might be what some voters decide. Not that we're for bail bond companies, but let's keep this system in there until we do better. And in fact, there is a court ruling in San Francisco, but could apply statewide, depending on what the state Supreme Court does, and I guess on the outcome of this vote, that would say that when bail is charged, the judge must take into account the ability of the defendant to pay, so that you can't just you can't simply charge something that you know they can't afford for a minor crime. And that would be, if 25 were to lose, that would be somewhat of a safeguard in the system, so that presumably judges could not hold people in jail simply because they can't afford it, even if they're not dangerous to release. So there's that factor to consider, too. There is somewhat of a backstop here.
Today we're talking about Proposition 25, which would transform how people get out of jail while awaiting trial. It would make California the first state to replace cash bail with an algorithm. We're talking about this with the San Francisco Chronicle's Bob Igelko. And if you have any questions or comments on Prop 25, we're going to talk about this for about five or so more minutes. So you can give us a call now at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Bob, can you tell us more about the algorithm? So this would make California the first state to replace cash bail with an algorithm. How would that work?
Well, even now, judges are already using, in most counties, are already using this type of formula to determine potential risk that defendants might pose. And this would broaden it, of course, because it would no longer be charged bail, so it would apply to more of them. These programs consider, as I said, such factors as the defendant's criminal record, work history, housing, community ties, and drug use, just some way of deciding, are they likely to endanger the public if we let them out without bail, because they no longer could be charged bail, while awaiting trial. And the Pretrial Justice Institute, which is a nonprofit that supports abolishing bail, said that these factors are, quote, data reflecting structural racism that could result in bias against the minorities. But there's one other thing I should say about this, though, that as a backstop, supporters of SB 10 passed a follow-up law, SB 36, that would require counties to examine these risk assessments, these algorithms, at least once every 3 years to determine their accuracy and any adverse impact. It's based on gender, race, or identity, and the Judicial Council is supposed to oversee that to get rid of any bias. So there is somewhat of a safeguard there. It wouldn't be immediate, but it's supposed to provide some state oversight so that the new system, simply isn't a way to hold more minorities in jail. And I think that's that generated some support among people of the left, the so-called bail reform movement, for SB 10, despite qualms about the algorithm.
Well, and also just quickly to add to this, Mano Raju, a public defender in San Francisco, says, my office has been working towards bail reform for the last several years. He's concerned that Prop 25 will put more power in the hands of judges who have a track record of using their discretion to keep people in jail unnecessarily. He says this could result in even more people staying in jail while they await trial or plead guilty just to gain release.
Yeah, I mean, that is certainly it's not an attitude or a position unique to Mr. Raju. There are a number of people on the defense side who say that this supposed reform is actually going to, just give us 58 new systems, one in each county, where judges can impose their own bias or attitudes or whatever. And there won't be much you can do about it because the decisions are largely up to judicial discretion. In response, I should say, there still doesn't seem to be any doubt that SB 10, Prop 25 will bring more people earlier than they are now, particularly those arrested for nonviolent misdemeanors, small-scale crimes, right away, rather than being held for at least 2 days and perhaps more. And then there is the SB 36 backstop that is supposed to screen the new system for racial bias and, make sure that it isn't used that way. Mr. Rogers is right. It does put a lot of power in the hands of individual judges. Maybe right now it's just held by bail bond companies, and now this would leave it up to the judges. But, of course, the judges are subject to popular vote and gubernatorial appointments, so presumably those are public policy decisions, too.
Bob Agelko is a staff writer at the San Francisco Chronicle. Thank you for joining us to talk about Prop 25, Bob.
Anytime.
Thank you. And you can find more information about Prop 25, which would transform how people get out of jail while awaiting trial, making California the first state to replace cash bail with an algorithm, at yourcallradio.org. Now we are going to talk about Proposition 14, the stem cell research bond. It would continue funding stem cell research in California by borrowing up to $5.5 billion in bonds. And to talk about Proposition 14, we are joined by Danielle Venton, a reporter for KQED Science. Hi, Danielle. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you. Well, this one is not getting that much attention, but it is a very important proposition because it is asking California voters if they want to keep funding the state's Stem Cell Research Institute, which was first created in 2004 after voters approved California Prop 71. And that allocated $3 billion to fund stem cell research in California. Prop 14 would allow the state to borrow $5.5 billion. Can you just talk about how and why this is on the ballot?
Yeah, absolutely. So when Prop 71 passed in 2004, as you said, it allowed the sale of $3 billion in bonds to create this stem cell agency. That money has effectively run out. And if the agency is going to continue its work funding stem cell research and regenerative medicine, it needs a new infusion of cash. And the background here is really important, like you hinted at. We could talk a little bit about what stem cells are to begin with.
Please.
So stem cells are undifferentiated cells that have not yet gained a special function, and they're found in human embryos at this stage just a few days after fertilization, and they're found in a few places in the human body, like in the bone marrow or the gonads. Scientists knew about these types of cells for a really long time, but it wasn't until the late 90s where they developed ways to direct how they developed, and the possibilities at that time for using them for medicine just seemed incredible, because most diseases are because some collection of cells is misfunctioning. That research was hampered in 2001 when then President George W. Bush banned federal funding for any research using human embryonic stem cells under pressure from anti-abortion groups. I think it's important to point out that human embryos that are developed, that are used to develop stem cell lines, are from in vitro fertilization treatments, and they are in effect unused embryos that are not going to be used. They're donated with informed consent from the couples or the parents who are trying to conceive. But that didn't make a difference in 2001 to the supporters of George W. Bush. California wanted to get around restrictions to that research. And so there was a lot of popular support, a lot of celebrities signed on to support Prop 71, including Christopher Reeve and Michael J. Fox at the time. The agency in the last 15 years has had some successes, but no kind of blockbuster therapy, you know, no cure for Alzheimer's or, you know, or general cancers. And, you know, insiders disagree with how successful its research funding has been, but it did not work out as envisioned that you know, this huge suite of diseases could be cured by stem cell research, at least not yet.
So this is interesting. So this is California Stem Cell Agency, the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine. Can you tell us more about this institute? You know, who is making the decisions about how the money is actually spent?
Yeah, so this institute is unique. There's no other state that has a research funding agency at this scale. It is run by a large board, nearly 30 people, and it does not have a lot of oversight by the legislature. It's sort of a standalone agency. There have been longstanding complaints about conflicts of interest within the board, and an audit a couple years ago revealed that about 80% of the funds given out by the agency has gone to institutions connected to board members, institutions like Stanford, UCSF, for example. And one of the criticisms about how Prop 14 is written is that the board would get even larger, increasing to 35 members, and there still would not be a lot of citizen or legislative oversight, and that the structural issues leading to complaints about conflicts of interest have not been addressed.
So let's talk about the support for this bill first. Proposition. Supporters have spent almost $10 million on this. Supporters include the University of California Board of Regents, the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research, Sickle Cell Disease Foundation, and major donors, again, are a couple of philanthropists, Dagmar Dolby, Robert Klein, a Silicon Valley real estate developer, and the California Institute's first board chair, along with JDRF International, formerly known as the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. So far, the yes side has spent almost $10 million. What is their main argument?
Yeah, their main argument is that this is critical research. It has saved lives and may save more in the future. And that if this agency is not refunded, that important research will stall, or the pace of it will decrease, and that health is a priority, and that this agency is filling a need that is otherwise unmet, and that this research needs to go forward.
And those opposed have only raised $250 or spent $250. That's probably the lowest number I've stated so far on these props. Those who are against it include the Los Angeles Times editorial board, the San Francisco Chronicle editorial board, Mercury News. Why are these editorial boards against it?
The primary argument against this on the no side comes down to financial concerns. This is research funded by debt, and these bonds have to be paid off over the course of 30 years. And that makes them about twice as expensive. If you have a $3 billion bond, by the time you've paid that off, you've dedicated almost $6 billion to it. Also, the funding need for human embryonic stem cell research is not today what it was in 2004. President Obama overturned the funding ban, and now the federal government through the NIH funds this research at the rate of about $300 million a year. What's also happened in the last 10 to 15 years is that there's more private funding in this sector, commonly from tech billionaires like the Zuckerbergs, the Benioffs, Sean Parker, and people who encourage a no vote on Proposition 14 say that these other sources of funding, both private and federal, will help replace the funding that is now seen from CIRM. You know, we know that we are at a time when in the state of California, we're facing huge budget deficits. Propositions funded by bond, this bond money has to be paid off out of the general fund first. And we still owe about $1 billion towards the debt created by Proposition 71. And if Prop 14 passes, the state will have to pay that off at the rate of about $260 million a year. And critics say that leaves less money for other state priorities like housing, transportation, and education. And they say that right now, the state of California just cannot afford it.
Well, we've got just a couple minutes left on the Proposition 14, the stem cell research bond. We're talking with KQED science reporter Danielle Venton. If you have any questions for her about Prop 14, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Danielle, what do the facts tell us about this comment from Jeff Sheehy, an HIV patient advocate and the only board member to oppose Prop 14? He said, quote, "What it does is basically takes all of our returns that we get from this and gives it back to the pharmaceutical and biotech companies. It becomes a blatant giveaway to these companies when we should be requiring access and requiring fair pricing." What does your reporting say about that?
Yes. So one of the hopes of the original, when this agency was created, was that there would be therapies developed and the state would be able to earn profits from that, royalties, and that potentially the agency would pay for itself. That has not happened. The state has reaped less than $500,000 in royalties. And the way that Proposition 14 is now written, the state is not able to earn any royalties directly from new therapies that would be created. Any money would be required to feed back into programs to make treatments more affordable for people. But what that effectively does, in Sheehy's thinking, is giving that money back to pharmaceutical companies or drug companies to bring down the cost of drug treatments. And he would rather see policies written that just requires any therapies that have state funding to be more affordable.
We have a question from a listener who says, how can we keep track of the work that this group is actually doing?
I mean, this group is fairly transparent. You can go to their website and look at their clinical trials dashboard. To date, they've funded 64 clinical trials, and they have aided in funding a further 30. You can see what researcher is the principal investigator for that trial, what institution they work at, how much money they got, what diseases they are studying, and what phase that trial is in. Trials start at phase one, which is just to check for basic safety, and then they move through step two, and step three is just before they are applicable for FDA approval and mass use.
And is there anything else you can tell us about the board and how they operate and how they would benefit from this?
So the board does not, when they don't directly vote on giving money to their institution, but the board directs the strategy of where funding priorities are. And so the criticism is that if you are connected to, say, a big university that specializes in a certain field of stem cell or regenerative medicine, you're more likely to support the strategy of funding research that is connected to your institution. Voting on specific grants, board members have to recuse themselves from votes that are connected to their specific institutions. Did that answer your question?
Yes. No, it definitely did. Thank you. I feel like we need to do a show about this institute to learn more about it. But no, thank you so much for your reporting. And thank you for going over this, because it's not getting that much attention, but it really is. It's very important. So thanks so much, Danielle. We appreciate hearing your pieces on KQED.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Danielle Venton is a reporter for KQED Science. We've been talking about Prop 14. It would have California continue funding stem cell research by borrowing up to $5.5 billion. It would generate the money to keep open the state's own stem cell agency, the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine, and expand its research capacity. And you can find more information about Prop 14, find out who's supporting it, who opposes it, and why. And you can also see how it is being bankrolled. Coming up after a quick break, we are going to talk about Prop 16, another very important prop. It would restore affirmative action in California. This is a special election Your Call series, and we'll be back after this. This is a special election edition of Your Call. This is the last day of our series. You can find all of our past shows at yourcallradio.org. And if you have not voted yet, be sure to check out KALW's election guide. The news department has put together election briefs. These are 2-minute overviews of all of the propositions and the measures. They always do a great job with this. So I hope you can take some time and check out those election briefs. Now we are going to talk about California Proposition 16, which would restore affirmative action in California, meaning universities and government offices could factor in someone's race, gender, or ethnicity in making hiring, spending, and admissions decisions. Joining us to talk about Prop 16 is Alexander Nieves, a reporter with Politico California. Hi, Alexander. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So Proposition 16 would repeal Proposition 209, which passed in 1996, and it stated that the government and public institutions cannot discriminate against or grant preferential treatment to persons on the basis of race, sex, color, ethnicity, or national origin. Can you first talk to us about how Prop 16 got on the ballot?
Yes. So, I mean, Prop 16 and what it is, a repeal of Prop 209, is one of the measures that progressive Democrats have been looking at since Prop 209 was passed by the voters in 1996. 6 years ago, we had an effort in the legislature to put a similar measure on the ballot that failed. But lawmakers, especially from the Legislative Black Caucus and Assemblywoman Shirley Weber from San Diego, have been looking at a way to get this on the ballot for years, and had a measure already in place that was going through this year. Then when George Floyd was killed at the hands of a police officer in Minneapolis, lawmakers saw a real opportunity to move forward with this, and it cleared the legislature on a pretty strong bipartisan vote and was placed on the ballot in July.
Berkeley Side has an interesting article called Black Students at UC Berkeley Spearheaded the Statewide Initiative to Restore Affirmative Action. And this piece by Brandon Young says, if it weren't for a handful of students at UC Berkeley, we might not be voting on this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have to give out a shout out to Berkeley, my alma mater as well. Students really pushed Assemblymember Weber and the legislature on this. There were pretty dynamic discussions throughout this process, and I think they really made it an issue, and I think made it timely for lawmakers to really ramp up their efforts. Because like I said, this is something that's been on the agenda for Democrats for a long time, but something that's usually been pushed to push to the background in Sacramento.
Right. And so I just want to give out the number. If anyone has questions about Prop 16, which would restore affirmative action in California, if you or anyone you know was affected by Proposition 209, which passed in 1996, 55% voter approval, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's first talk about the effects that Prop 209 had. In this Berkeley Side article, it says people from underrepresented groups who applied to UC Berkeley after Prop 209 were 31% less likely to be accepted, according to a report issued by the UC Office of the President. UC Berkeley witnessed a drop in the percentage of Black students following the passage of Prop 209.
Mm-hmm. Yes, not just Black students, but also Native American students. We saw significant drops. And in Latino students, so this year, Latino students for the first time were the largest group of students admitted to the UC. But it still falls well below the Latino population, the percentage of Latinos who make up California. I mean, what happened here was you saw direct programs aimed at helping students of color through scholarships, through direct considerations and applications go away, and the schools had to lean more on test scores, on GPA. So, yeah, pretty quickly, I think Prop 209 did what it may have been set out to do. It really changed the makeup of incoming student classes at the UC.
Right. As you point out, in the 24 years since 1996, Latino residents have surpassed white Californians as the state's largest ethnic group. But because of 209, the number of Latino students, Black students, Native students has actually gone down. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about other effects of the passage of Prop 209?
Yeah. Like I mentioned earlier, it's not just about admissions, but it also has to do with direct scholarships in education. That's a major impact, especially at the graduate student level, where there's not as much federal funding that impacts students of color. And then beyond schools, we're looking at contracting and government hiring. It's made it more difficult for women, especially, to get government contracts. I think the statistics have shown that white women are actually the group that benefits the most from affirmative action. And in places like San Francisco, you've seen Asian-owned businesses getting contracts at lower rates than cities like Chicago and Atlanta that have affirmative action policies. So it goes beyond just education.
And so supporters basically say that when you talk about affirmative action, for example, it says principles should be applied. Public universities should be able to consider a student's race as one of a number of admission factors, including grades and schoolwork. Supporters say, as for the growth in Latino admissions at the UC, this is very good news, but affirmative action could have led to these increases much sooner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
And I think we should note that. I mean, you know, those of us who are first generation college students, you know how important this is, because we don't mm-hmm. come from, and I'm speaking from experience here, we don't come from families who, you know, either have money or have a lot of experience with the system. We've seen how money can really also get you into school mm-hmm. with these scandals that have happened over the past couple of years. So supporters say that this information really should be factored in.
Yeah, and when you look at what is already factored in, neighborhood can be factored in, income can be factored in. There's a lot of things that can be factored in that schools look at to try to get this picture, but when it comes to race and gender, that is left out. So at the very final point when colleges are making these decisions, or when a government agency is trying to get about a contract, that is taken out of their hands. So, supporters would say that and makes the job a lot more difficult and a lot less targeted, and that without targeted approaches, it's hard to address something like racial inequality.
And supporters of Proposition 16 include the California Community Colleges, California State University, Governor Gavin Newsom, University of California. The Yes side has spent almost $16 million. Major donors include California Teachers Association, Kaiser Foundation Health Plan, and hospitals. That's interesting. Do you know why Kaiser is in favor of this?
My coworkers and I have been theorizing about this, and actually the numbers are about 20 million in donations.
It's gone up.
Okay. Just checked the Secretary of State website this morning. No, I don't have an exact answer about Kaiser. I've had theories that it could have to do with hiring, but I think you see a very robust group in support, including groups that were previously not in support, like some Asian American community organizations, because there's a real dynamic shift in California. We're definitely not where we were in the 90s, and I don't think there's a lot of appetite to oppose Prop 16, as evidenced by the $1 million the no side has. But still, it's a tough issue that I think voters are undecided on.
And so on the no side, you've got Californians for Equal Rights, the California Republican Party, Chinese American Civic Action Alliance, and Students for Fair Admissions, and Anti-Affirmative Action Group. And I'll just read the opponent's argument. This is from Cal Matters. It says, allowing schools and government offices to make decisions based on race, ethnicity, or sex is its own kind of prejudice. Equal rights means everyone is treated equally. What else are opponents saying about Proposition 16?
Yeah, I think a lot of the opposition goes back to an idea that has been discussed a lot since the Supreme Court ruled in 1978 that affirmative action is legal, but the question of quotas is what always comes up. And there's still a fear that this would reduce the population of white and Asian American students at the UC system. And that it would come back to a place where there is quotas in education. And realistically, quotas were never huge in the UC. Obviously, UC Davis had quotas in 1978, which is why we had a Supreme Court case. But yeah, I think a lot of the arguments are the same that were being made in the mid-90s.
What are you hearing from voters about this issue? I mean, we have so much on the ballot right now, and this one is not getting that much attention, even though it is so important. You point out that a poll conducted last month by the Public Policy Institute of California found that 31% of voters plan to vote yes on 16, so for affirmative action, while 47% lean no, 22% are undecided.
Yeah, and there was also another poll from Berkeley IGS that had support at 33%. So I think as a reporter and just an observer of politics, I was surprised, and I know most of the folks around this campaign were surprised by how low those numbers are. And I think the realization that's been that we've all had is that a lot of people don't understand why this is on the ballot now or where it came from. I think the process of the legislature putting it on the ballot surprised people, and when it showed up in July, folks hadn't heard about it like they've heard about Prop 22 or Prop 15 for years, really. So I think a lot of people are surprised to see it. And I think there's also some real confusion about what affirmative action means and how it ties into racial inequality. There was a poll conducted by the Latino Community Foundation that found that 50% of Latinos supported the measure after reading the ballot summary. But when they were told that it could increase the population of Latinos at the UC, that jumped to 76% support.
Wow.
So, yeah, I think people are confused, really, about what this means and what it could do to California in the future.
Well, and it's also really interesting when you look at the data. I mean, we talked about the fact that the number of Black students, Latino students, Native students actually dropped at UCs after Prop 209 passed. And then in your piece, you report that businesses owned by women and people of color potentially lost more than $1 billion a year in government contracts in the year since Prop 209 passed. And this is according to a study by the Equal Justice Society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think those statistics are certainly compelling and should give the yes on Prop 16 campaign plenty of good material here. But like you mentioned, there is such a crowded ballot and we're already so late in the process. And we've seen already a million votes casted, a million ballots submitted. So I think the Prop 16 campaign still has a chance of increasing support, but they got to get those statistics that you just read off out there in front of people's eyes with the few weeks that we have left.
Right, because we have a listener who wrote in and said, how have people's views about affirmative action really changed over the years? Do most people know what it means anymore?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a serious question, a really good question. Certainly, I think folks who were around to vote for Prop 209 have changed their views. I believe that there's a stronger support of base for affirmative action policies. But one group we really don't know about is the 18 to 40 age group, folks who never were around for that conversation. There's a real concern that they don't really know about affirmative action and have never lived in a reality other than Prop 209. So that group is certainly an interesting one and really will determine how this goes.
Well, $20 million is a big chunk of change. If the yes side has raised $20 million, what are they doing to get the word out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and $20 million in a normal campaign, I would say, is a lot. In this campaign, not quite as much when Uber and Lyft are spending hundreds of millions of dollars. But still, it is enough that they can get their word out there. So I think a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, we saw our first TV ads. There was an ad during the vice presidential debate, and they're working hard on getting their supporters to get the message out there. So that's the Golden State Warriors and the San Francisco 49ers, for instance, Governor Gavin Newsom and Kamala Harris, and over 100 national and state organizations who have lent support. So they're hoping that those organizations can get the word out and really put out a simple message that Democrats support this and that it helps racial inequality. Because this late in the stage, I don't think they can make a very nuanced argument and try to explain what affirmative action does.
Hmm. Well, so again, we're talking about Proposition 16, and this would restore affirmative action in California, meaning universities and government offices could factor in someone's race, gender, or ethnicity in making hiring, spending, and admissions decisions. This has been illegal in California since 1996 when voters approved another prop that banned affirmative action. And as we were talking about earlier, Alexander looked up the latest numbers. The yes side has spent $20 million. They include the California Community Colleges and the California State University System, Governor Gavin Newsom, University of California. The Los Angeles Area Chamber of Commerce supports this. Do you know why they support it?
Chambers of Commerce and labor both support this, which is one of the amazing things about this measure. You don't see labor and business come together like that. I think it's a sign of changing dynamics in California. I know a lot of chambers of commerce support businesses owned by women and people of color, and I've seen those businesses struggle to get contracts. So I think for them, it's a practical means of seeing a lot more businesses owned by people of color get support.
Hmm. And then those opposed, they've spent just over $1 million. This includes Students for Fair Admissions. They oppose affirmative action, the California Republican Party. Before we let you go, Alexander, early voting is just, it's incredible to watch what's happening across mm-hmm. the country. It's just breaking records. Have you been able to follow what's happening with college students? Because, you know, because of COVID, a lot of students have not gone back to school. Some have, and we were concerned that that would really affect their ability to vote. Do you have any idea how that's going?
No, that's actually a really interesting question and one I'm going to have to dive into. But given that everyone has received their ballots, I'm guessing the early voting class is the group of people who've already decided fairly early on what they're going to vote for. That tends to skew older. It'll be interesting to see what the turnout is among younger voters, but can't say that I know off the top of my head how it is yet.
Well, thank you. Yeah, this would be a great story to write, just because, you know, if you go to school and then maybe you came home and there's so much confusion around COVID. We were hoping that young people really do vote in big numbers. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Alexander. Thank you again for going over Proposition 16 with us.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Alexander Nieves is a reporter with Politico California. And you can find all of the shows that we have done over the last 2 weeks focusing on California propositions. We also spoke about San Francisco measures, and we talked about the race between Senator Scott Wiener and Jackie Fielder. Senator Wiener declined our invitation to debate. So we had Tim Redmond of 48 Hills talking about his record, and then Jackie Fielder joined us. And you can find those shows at yourcallradio.org. Find all of our election coverage at kalw.org, including the news department's election briefs. They are doing a 2-minute overview on all of the propositions and local measures. They always do a great job with this. So I hope you can take some time to listen to that. And if you want to follow the money, which is always very important, be sure to check out Cal Matters Voting Guide. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing all of these election shows. Thanks to Damian Miner for keeping our studio running. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.